Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome back to Buzz Podcast. I'm Trev Downey. I'm joined by Dave Hendrick, and this week we're going to speak about The Silence of the Lambs, a 1991 classic by Jonathan Demme from the Thomas Harris novel from, I think, 1988 of the same name. And I cannot wait to get into this one, Dave. No, unusually, that we've both done an intensive watch-up literally only last night, so it's going to be nice and fresh in the memory. Just to get us going, give me just your initial reaction to having seen this movie again, probably after quite a while, I imagine.
Yeah, it had been a while. It had been probably 5-6 years maybe, and I watched it during the week with herself, but we were obviously waffling through it, so I didn't, you know, you're not really paying full attention. So then you were watching it last night, and I thought, when herself went to bed, I thought, you know what, I'm going to watch it again and actually properly just focus on it, put my phone in the other room and just literally sat watching it. And you're just in awe of how good a film this is and how good every aspect of it is. Like, I'm sure you've read the novel. It's so good. And oftentimes when a great book gets turned into a movie, they don't really do it justice. But in this one, like, Jonathan Demme absolutely nails it. You've got best actor and best actress winning performances from Hopkins and Foster. And the supporting cast is phenomenal in it as well. And even now, where we're sitting 33 years after it came out, it still feels fresh. Like, it still feels relevant to now. It's a timeless film.
It's the intensity of it is constantly surprising. So obviously when it came out first, this is primo era where I'm really interested in the medium and starting to really take it on board as a serious thing that I'm very actually animatedly interested about. So I remember getting this out on VHS at the time and watching it a few times, and yeah, it's brilliant. You put it on the shelf, then you see on TV again, maybe a few years later, and you go, holy shit, that was amazing. And then, of course, there's the whole Hannibal legacy that's grown up around it. So there's a very excellent TV show, which I know you're a fan of. There's all the spin-off movies that happened in the wake of it. Some of them, including some of the original cast, some not. And they are all very watchable and enjoyable, and they have all got their own merits in different ways, shape, and form. Some notable things, including a couple of sort of remakes and the like. But this thing is head and shoulders above all of them, without a question. The horror of it rivals any moment of horror in the TV show, which was famed for its sort of shock capacity. The intensity of it rivals any moment in any of the other movies or any moment in the TV show, in my opinion. It's just, as you say, when you watch it again, the freshness just comes from the powerful filmmaking. And it's really, really interesting to think about it, because I remember all I knew about Jonathan Demme over the years was this and the music movie that he did, Stop Making Sense. for Talking Heads. I was aware of that. You know, David in the big square-shouldered baggy suit, and you're aware of that as a thing, and it's one of the most famous sort of concert movies ever made. And I was listening to Demi talking about it, and he's a huge music fan and grew up in a house that was all about music. And if you look at his, even in this one we're going to talk about later on, he picks this sort of not really well-known artist to have the music for the famous sort of scenes with Bill in his his lair, and that becomes a massive hit on the back of the movie. And he's always been interested in music. And I'm just thinking, okay, well, that's all I really knew about Jonathan Demme. And then, you know, I'll be honest, when I went to look him up last night, you know, the early work is really interesting. We're going to come to that because of a connection in terms of the casting in this one later on, and a crossover with something that we're going to do later on. And that's basically his early days working for the famous sort of B-movie, exploitation movie guru, Roger Corman. And he does a few movies for Roger Corman. And then, you know, he casts Roger Corman in his movies afterwards. And that tended to happen. And people who don't know who Corman is, like, his movies sort of gave a chance to people like Jack Nicholson to get a foothold. And he's a very famous Hollywood figure as a result of that. But I was aware of Stop Making Sense. I remember Married to the Mob, which came out in 88, and it was his movie just before Silence of the Lambs. Everyone recalls his immediate movie after Silence of the Lambs, which is Philadelphia, which again was another Oscar fest and had music very much at the core of it as well. And then he does Beloved, based on the Toni Morrison book, which I've read. I haven't seen that movie. He does a version of The Manchurian Candidate in 2004, which is the only other one that I was aware of. And then Rachel Getting Married in 2008. I've heard lots about it because it's a kind of a low-key, by comparison with some of his other ones, almost like an indie-type atmosphere to it. But I don't know any of the other things on his. I'm not going to pretend to know any of the other things on Jonathan Demme's CV. And yet, for me, Jonathan Demme stands out, if it's only for this and Philadelphia and Stop Making Sense. That's your calling card right there, Dave.
And that's more than enough. Like, that's three unbelievable movies. And in fairness, Silence of the Lambs and Philadelphia back-to-back might well be the best back-to-back any director's ever had. Like, that is outrageous to have done the two of those. I know I've seen Fighting Mad, the Peter Fonda film, which was one of his early ones.
Yeah.
I don't remember a whole lot about it. I've seen Swimming to Cambodia, which is strange. Married to the Mob is quite good. But these, like, it's... This is where he hits with Silence of the Lambs and Philadelphia. Like, it just absolutely outrageous levels of success. And the types of films that every director just wants to make one of. Like, one seminal moment in film history. One calling card. And he does two back-to-back. And like you said, Stop Making Sense is also... It's brilliant because it's of the way it's done and how unique it is.
Do you remember, I'm typing in as we speak, man types on live broadcast, who the fuck was he up against in 1991 for Best Director? Because I'm just looking at it here, and he hasn't got an Academy Award nomination for, when was Philadelphia was 92, was it 3?
Philadelphia 93. Was 93. So year was Spielberg for Schindler's List, Robert Altman for Shortcuts, Jane Campion for The Piano.
Right.
James Ivory for The Remains of the Day, and Jim Sheridan for The Name of the Father. That was that year.
Right, that's a tough one to break into.
Yeah, that was a big year, though. There was a lot of big films in 93.
Yeah.
So in 91... he wins it for Silence, but like he's up against Ridley Scott for Thelma and Louise, which is another groundbreaking film. John Singleton for Boys in the Hood, which is one of the best films I think ever made.
You see, both of those films, they're important, but in their own sort of genre, this thing kind of surpasses that, I think.
Exactly.
So far, I'm on board. Go on.
Oliver Stone for JFK.
Okay, well, we've talked about that one before. It's a belter, but yeah.
and Barry Levinson for Bugsy.
That'd be the wild card there for me. I couldn't get my head around that and the hype around it. I really couldn't.
No, I wouldn't be a big fan of that. I think a lot of people overrate that film because of the source material. Obviously, Bugsy Siegel is you know, one of the legendary gangsters, but also like Warren Beatty, Annette Bening, Harvey Keitel, Ben Kingsley. It's a hell of a cast.
Yeah, of course.
I think that's generally why it's kind of overrated.
There might have been a Warren Beatty thing as well because he was such Hollywood royalty for ages, and you know, you know how they work. Sometimes it's just your number comes up. It's your turn. Can be sometimes what happens here. Anyway, back to this unbelievable film that we want to talk about today. And for those who, for some reason, have lived under a rock and aren't 100% sure who we're talking about here or what we're talking about this wonderful psychological horror. It is Jonathan Demme. It is from that Thomas Harris novel. And the cast is absolutely fantastic. Everyone's almost like just no perfect casting. Anthony Hopkins as Lecter is like, you know, one of the cinematic canon characters of all time. And to be fair, Jodie Foster as Clarice Starling is, I think, equally iconic. It's really, it's just to take a little diversion here for a sec. Isn't it fascinating to watch young Jodie with her like little glowing face and her youthful, you know, very specific beauty at that point of her career, when you've been used to looking at the more hard-bitten version of her in True Detective 4 recently, both equally powerful screen presences. But I think she does, brilliantly all the way through this. I don't know if this is something you particularly made note of, or if it's something that everybody does. But she does this thing. It's a kind of trend throughout the movie, because Scott Glenn's character is Crawford, the her FBI kind of guru, is constantly putting her in these test situations, and she does this thing where she goes from emotionally vulnerable and a bit scared and a bit sort of shaky to finding her feet and becoming this, you know, cool, calm, professional presence. And she does that thing really well. And of course, then when the scenes with Hannibal, it's exactly the same process. And she has to show this fragility, vulnerability, the fact that she is very much a newbie. She's learning on her feet, but then she gets into the zone and you can see this transformation happening. And even right down to the end, the confrontation with Bill, there's that, you know, night vision sequence where she's fucking terrified. And you can only imagine what it'd be like to be in pitch dark with a guy like that literally after you. And she manages in that like climactic sort of set face off, she manages to get the upper hand again through just that coldness in the moment of being able to draw and pull the trigger first and put, you know, get her little victory in that situation. And it's a lovely process. And here's a long-winded way of saying, what an incredible actress.
Oh, she is absolutely phenomenal. So this came out early 91, so it would have been filmed in 90. So she was 27, turning 28 when this was being made.
And she looks like a little dewy-faced
20-year-old. She does, doesn't she?
Yeah.
But you know what's crazy about it is, like, this film comes out nearly 15 years after Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
So while she is young, she's got the better part of 20 years from Napoleon and Samantha up until this. 20 years of experience. She's already won an Academy Award. She'd won Best Actress in a Leading Role for The Accused only a couple of years beforehand. Like, her talent level, absolutely off the charts. Like, I think there's a really strong case for Jodie Foster being, if not, certainly on the Mount Rushmore of actresses that we've ever seen. I think she's incredible.
You can't argue that because, you know, that like that role as Iris in Taxi Driver is one that everybody's going to remember. But like, I mean, you know, and of course it's great work, But it's more about the iconic nature of what that movie turned into, as opposed to what is comparatively small part in it. She's great in it, of course, but she's only a kid. But like you said then, it's how it builds. And these constant huge performances, these constantly amazing performances, like where she's, do you know what? Soon after Silence of the Lambs, she does a movie, I think it was in 93 or 4 with Mel Gibson called Maverick.
Yeah.
And she just plays this sort of Southern belle hustler who can handle herself and, you know, probably has a derringer under every fold of her flouncy dress. And she's, you know, she's brilliant in it because, again, she can do lighthearted, she can do comedy bits. I particularly love that movie because it's just pure entertainment. It's old Hollywood. It's just fun. And James Garner's in it as Maverick's dad. But she's brilliant and totally holds her own and plays the two boys off against each other.
That's it. And that would have been Gibson right at his peak as well.
I mean, you're talking about Hollywood royalty. You're talking about, again, you know, Gibbo was on a roll there if he hadn't done the things where you're talking about, again, another lad who could very well be certainly the Rushmore of film stars, if not actors. Yeah. You know, you're talking about a guy, he literally couldn't miss. Everything he touched turned to gold.
Yeah.
And it felt a little bit like, what I'm saying is, she's standing there alongside him at his absolute supernova best, and she's right on the same level.
Oh, that's, you know, it. And it's almost effortless for her.
Yeah.
Like, it's effortless for her. And that same year, she did Nell with Liam Neeson, and she was nominated for Best Actress for that as well.
Yeah.
And it's a totally different film, totally different character, totally different genre, totally different demands on the role. And again, she's phenomenal in it. Like, her ability to turn her hand to different things is just incredible.
Do you think that something happened? I don't know enough about the lady and what happened, but like, when you look at that run, like she's like, you know, Silence of the Lambs, Little Man Tate, which was highly rated, Summersby, which is a huge hit, Maverick, Nell, then 97, 3 years later, there's a big gap there. As for an actress, that's a long gap, and then it's Contact. That's a huge movie and a much loved sort of sci-fi classic that some people think isn't sci-fi anymore. Then she does Anna and the King 2 years later, and that's another huge, big budget film as well. And then I remember the next thing after that I remember from her was Panic Room, which was, again, a sort of big name director, and, you know, you can hang your hat on Jodie Foster, she's going to do a good job, and she did, of course. But there's something that happens then after that. Like the movies after that, Abby Singer, A Very Long Engagement, Flight Plan, then Inside Man, then The Brave One, Nim's Island, The Beaver, Carnage, Elysium. Nobody's really noting anything there. Elysium was a big budget.
Inside Man.
I like it as well, but I guess what I'm saying is, you're not looking at, like, where's the movies that reflect her absolute, like, you know, queen of Hollywood status? They're not there. And
they're,
I'm wondering, is it the thing that happens to a lot? Did she fall foul of the thing that happens to a lot of actresses, which is like, well, you can't do the leading lady roles anymore. You're a bit old. Like, is it that shit?
I don't know. I really don't know. I don't know whether she just decided to take a step back because she'd worked. Like, as you said, like, from Anna and the King, there's a 3-year gap. You have to remember, when Panic Room comes out, that's 30 years after her first film comes out. And she's only 40. So three quarters of her life, maybe she just got burnt out. Maybe she decided she didn't want to play the game anymore. Maybe she fell foul of certain Hollywood executives who a lot of actresses fell foul of because they wouldn't give in to certain wants and desires. Like, I don't know, but it is very, very, like, there's her career has been in multiple acts. Like, there's that early phase where she's just sort of finding who she is and gaining stardom. Then she has this incredible run through the late 80s and the 90s. Then there's that run where, like I said, I love Inside Man, but when I think of Inside Man, I think Denzel, I think Clive Owen. I don't think Jodie Foster.
Yeah, I guess that's what I mean about her being front and center. I know a lot of people, I've heard people talk about the Brave one, say it's great. And like, it just like, again, the source of all truth, with a very big asterisk beside it. If you just, it's actually, I suppose, easy enough to see. If you look at the Wikipedia page, the 2000s label is career setbacks and resurgence in thrillers. So it's her popping up in these, you know, things like Flight Plan, things like, The Brave One.
Yeah.
Inside Man. And then 2010s, the headline for that chunk of her career is focused on directing, which again may well have gone unnoticed by me in my ignorance, that she may have done lots of stuff that I'm not aware of. You know,
she only directed one film.
Right.
She directed The Beaver with Mel Gibson, which I think was kind of Gibson's sort of comeback movie, wasn't it?
That was the big story at the time, was that nobody would touch him except Jody, who loved him and thought he was a wonderful guy. And the, you know, the on the set of Maverick and stuff like that, they used to be sending like frozen rats to each other. She, both pranksters, and she just thought, he's a decent man. He's lost his way, and he had a dark spell. So yeah, she reached out the olive branch. That's very interesting. Probably says a lot about her as well. That, you know, she would be willing to do that, and of course, most people thought that was, you know, daft beyond words. It's a very unusual movie. But it was a brave choice by her, brave choice by Gibson to do the role, because it's, like I say, it's not exactly action hero, right?
No.
And it is what it is. I love little movies like that because I find them quirky and interesting. But it's a focus on direction, it says here. And yet, as you say, maybe not.
That's the thing. And then, like, I think this decade, she's having a good run. I liked The Mauritanian when I saw it. I thought it was really good. Naiad is, I don't know if you've seen it. It's really, really good. It's about Diana Nyad's desire to swim the Straits of Florida, and she's cast in a supporting role. I think she got an Oscar nod on that one as well.
To the aforementioned Annette Bening, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then obviously we've just done True Detective, which I think will launch her to a new generation of fans that maybe aren't as aware of what she's done in the past, and might start, you know, going down the rabbit hole of watching some of these older films. And if they're going to, then absolutely The Silence of the Lambs is the first film to start with, because she is just so perfect in that role.
I've spoken a little bit about, you know, her physical appearance on the screen, and it's very much, put front and center by Demme's direction. And he's noted for his close-ups. It's one of the things that's a real feature of a Jonathan Demme film. And, you know, I've heard lots of, you know, highly rated actors, including one of my favorites, Paul Thomas Anderson. He was asked one time, you know, who are the three directors that have influenced you most? And he said, Jonathan Demme, which, you know, was kind of tongue in cheek. But at the same time, you know, you look at some of his movies, P.T. Anderson loves a close up as well. And Jodie's face is filling the frame so many times, as she's usually walking towards the camera or reacting to something fucking horrific, or, having to deal with a moment of mortification or embarrassment or humiliation or whatever it is. And like, her face is just incredible. She's not a big gestures person. She can do a lot with a little wrinkle of her mouth and a little bit of acting with her eyes. And it's such a feature of the film, is her face. It's like filling the screen. Like I say, in these moments of extreme tension, that it's one of the things you take away afterwards. And I think she looks so perfect for this, as this sort of absolute newbie recruit. Does not look a bit 27, do you know what I mean? We've focused a lot on her now, but man alive, the cast around her are unbelievable. And like, obviously Hopkins will speak about, because how could you not, because it's one of the iconic film roles ever. But some of the rest of the people, like Scott Glenn, doesn't get enough love for his work in cinema over the years, in my opinion. the takeaway for me, the absolute, like, outrageously wonderful sort of magnetic performance for me is Ted Levine as Buffalo Bill. Because I don't know what it is about Ted Levine in terms of just, he's an unusual looking chap, you know, very sort of imposing physical presence, yeah. But also with the receding hairline and the straggly long hair, and then the voice, Dave. Like, what is Ted Levine's voice? From the minute that girl goes over to help the lad who's pretending to have a busted arm put a sofa in the back of his van, if I had heard the voice, I'd have been walking backwards the other way.
100%.
Right? It's so quirky. And then there's these little moments that Levine has during the movie as Buffalo Bill that I remember when I see them, I alternate. There's one in particular I alternate between horror and pure, like, I can't control myself giggling at it. The scene where he's looking down the well at the girl we've just spoken about, who's his last victim, and she is screaming, and it's horrifying. She's screaming absolutely uncontrollably, just pure fear. And she does such a, like, it's such a brilliantly communicated anxiety and fear. And he's looking at her, and he's got that little tilt on his head, and he starts impersonating her scream, you know? And he's making the sound, trying to imitate it. Is he taking the piss? Is he trying to learn how to scream like a woman? You're not really sure, but it's comical to look at, or it's horrific as all hell, depending on the mood you're in, you know? And then later on when he's, it is later on when he's putting on the makeup and doing himself up and trying to evoke this transformation in himself. And he's getting, you know, the early touches of what he's going to look like when he finally has his fucking skin suit made. He's talking to himself as he's putting on the lipstick. And it's just so creepy.
Yeah.
It's so creepy. Again, the voice really helps there.
The voice is just, it's so unique. Like, it's such a unique sound. I don't know how or what it is, but it would creep you out. The look of him would creep you out. A good friend of mine, Graham Murray, many years ago, after a few drinks, would have been the type of fella who'd break out a Buffalo Bill impression and could do it to a phenomenal degree.
Really?
Oh, absolutely outrageous. And yeah, I mean, it's just like we did our top 10 movie villains last week, obviously, and we both talked about Buffalo Bill as one. I don't think he didn't make the cut for either of us.
No, but he got mentioned by both.
Yeah, because you have to, because, like, as terrifying as Lecter is, this guy's as scary, because you know what he's doing. You don't see him do it, but you've been told what he's doing. He's skinning women alive for the purposes of making himself a skin suit. And he has that, like, that just threatening way about him, but in a really creepy kind of way. And like you said, like, if you saw someone struggling with the couch or the armchair, whatever it was, into the back of the van, and you heard that voice and you caught a look of him, you'd be like, do you know what? I might send someone else over to help you, but I'm just going to go way, way over here. And you stay way, way over there.
That's really good. People respond to the sound of, and the timbre of a voice. And I just, it was designed to be unsettling, and hats off. It's a great job. Maybe what we'll do now is if we take a run through some of the highlights of the movie, and then as we're doing that, we can speak about Anthony Hopkins, because if we don't do that, we'll have been absolutely negligent. But I don't want to miss out on some of the highlights. And I'm just kind of aware that we're about half an hour in here. So I did my usual thing as I'm looking through it and I'm making notes. And of course, you know, when you see Quantico, you're going to be dealing with the FBI. And that's like sort of shorthand at this stage. And looking at the credits, I'm seeing Roger Corman and Chris Isaac, and I'm going, oh, well, let's talk about them lads. You know, the Chris Isaac thing is interesting because, again, it's back to Demi's real fascination with musicians and music. And he casts loads of them in his movies, just as a matter of course. And we see, speaking of courses, little trainee Jody on the assault course, and coming in her training gear into Crawford's office, and we're made aware that this is the behavioral science unit, and this is, you know, the place that will become the focus of so many TV shows, right? Because everyone loves psychology and crime together. It's a great mix, a heady mix, but we need to remember that this is before all of them. Right, this is ahead of its time, and as she's looking around the office, we get this really shocking images of Buffalo Bill headlines and the pictures of his victims who have been skinned. And Scott Glenn comes in then, and we're aware immediately, like I say, of the premise of things like Mindhunter, which is a show that we mentioned earlier on, Jodie Foster working with maybe I didn't mention Fincher on Panic Room, but you know, people know Fincher, and Mindhunter is such a wonderful show that for some reason has not been given a third season yet. There is some rumors that it might get it, but here we are, and it seems like this is probably one of the first things to deal with this idea that would become the staple stuff of Hollywood TV and movies. The idea of behavioral analysis, psychology, these absolute lunatic criminals, and analyzing what makes them tick. And you can forget, can't you, Dave, that this is actually, you know, one of the, if not the progenitor of all of those things that become, like, they're just staples that people watch having a cup of tea in the evening.
That's the thing. And, like, you watch this film, and, like, as I said earlier, it's so fresh, and it still feels like there's still a newness to it, that if you didn't know, like, if someone just put this on and you had no idea what it was, you'd be watching it and thinking, oh, God, they've borrowed from this and they've borrowed from that.
Yeah.
Where in actuality, all those things have borrowed from this. This was kind of the precursor to so much that we've seen in the last 30 years.
It's such efficient filmmaking, because we immediately established the dynamic. Scott Glenn's character has a lot of admiration for young Clarice. He may also be exploiting several aspects of her as a person, because she is young and pretty, and maybe he thinks that will help. But he has a specific plan to utilize her. But again, as the movie develops, whether it's because she earns his respect more, or because she always had it, we see this fondness developing. There's little hints made all along the way that, you know, they might be fond of each other in a different way than that. And I think that's all very, it's possibly potentially could be seen as a little bit creepy. I don't think it's played that way at all. And if you want creepy, immediately after he's sent her off to go and interview Lecter and said, you don't want Hannibal Lecter inside your head, be careful, we encounter Anthony Heal's Dr. Chilton. And he is a proper creeper. He's all over. He's all over Clarice. Can't wait to sort of talk to her more. He sees an opportunity here to act like Billy Big Bollocks, and she deals with him so well and gives him the brush off. And then we're coming to the first set piece. This is the set piece, really, of the movie, where you have the approach to Hannibal, you have the conversation with Hannibal, you have the walk away from Hannibal, you have the horrors that occur to her, the call back to him, and then we're off and we're running, and we've established this relationship that's going to be at the core of the film. But Dave, like, what an intense few minutes of film this is.
It's unbelievably good. Like, Anthony Heal, I'm a big fan of Anthony Heal. I think he adds to every film, largely because he comes across as a proper creepy folk in most things that he does.
Yeah.
But he's obviously very well known for, like, he was in, I think, the first three or four John Grisham-based films, you know, the ones that were The Client, The Pelican Brief and A Time to Kill.
Okay.
He's in all of them, and he's excellent in them. And he's just an unlikable sort. He has an unlikable haircut and an unlikable face. And in this, we're 20 seconds in to his appearance, and you want to punch him repeatedly in the gob because he's just an unlikable sort. But before we meet Lecter, when Heald's character is giving Clarice the rules, and he's like, don't approach the glass, don't touch the glass, don't do this, you're like, what on earth are we about to witness here? Like, they build up Lecter so brilliantly from the first moment he's mentioned by Scott Glenn's character, by Jack Crawford. From the first moment he mentions him to Clarice's response of Hannibal the Cannibal. And you're like, oh, interesting.
Yeah.
And then we go on and she meets Anthony Heald, Dr. Frederick Chilton, and the way he describes him and the way he describes the rules and all this kind of stuff. And you're just like, you're already on edge before we even get sight of him. You're on edge because they've built it so brilliantly through just those couple of interactions and those few little dropped lines. And then we meet him, and it's just phenomenal. Like, Hopkins in this role is just phenomenal. And obviously, Hopkins is an old man now. He's 86 years of age. And you kind of think of him as, you know, he's kind of a nice old man, because you see him being interviewed, and he's lovely, and he's a really nice guy. And yet you see him in this role, and you would think that if you could imagine the worst nightmare that anybody has ever had times 10, and you still wouldn't come close to this fella.
You couldn't. You couldn't. And I really want to get into having a bit of a chat about Hopkins with you, if that's okay, because, you know, so he was born 37, so 97, he'd have been 60, so he's 53 here, right? And he just still has enough physicality in that tight-fitting outfit that he's in that he looks like you wouldn't want to get into too much of a slaps session with him. But it's not that. It's not the physicality. It's just, you know, he has enough physical strength to do whatever he needs to do in this film. That's important, but it's the face, it's the stance, it's the voice, it's the whole thing. And just before we do get into that and pull this scene apart a little bit more, I think it's really important to just mention these things as well, because, like, it was a throwaway thing I said earlier on about Jonathan Demme being a wonderful director, and I don't know a whole lot of his work, but the films that I do know, specifically this one in this moment, it just shows such a deftness of touch. Like, I mean, you can see the difference between a well-directed and a shoddily directed movie. And you're talking there about how the tension is built up, how the reputation is built up, the way in which the approach to Hannibal is shot and the reveal shot of Hannibal himself. All of these things are expertly done. And don't fool yourself. Yes, an editor helps, but that has to be in the camera. It has to be in the can in the first place, because it's part of the vision of the director. And it's not said often enough. Where you see absolutely wonderful examples of good direction. I do want to throw that in there, but like you say, when we meet him, holy shit. I think the stance is amazing, but it's again, the tension, like, all the oddballs along the corridor and the real feral lad, I think it's Miggs, who's sort of smelling at her. And then, you know, Barney, the guy played by Frankie Faison, the guard, he just says, I'll be watching, you know. Mm. But when you see the reveal, the first reveal shot is the really unusual stance that Hannibal has. It's at once kind of foolish and terrifyingly threatening. And when we hear his voice for the first time, he's like, closer. And he's the rolling the oars and the little kind of, he slips into this sort of he can do impressions really quickly. He's constantly taking the piss out of Jody's West Virginia background, and he does the little old boy voice and stuff like that. But I can't get over how much threat is implicit in this guy. And you can dress him up however you want. He is, like we said, a man in his almost mid-50s. He is not in Hollywood shape. He is not, like, you know, luscious hair and traditionally handsome. He doesn't have a kind of like Jaws from the Bond movies sort of freak show physicality. So it's all hanging on his performance. And nobody, if you can think as much as you want through Hollywood and the movies that you've seen, there aren't many people who can embody threat in a comparatively small physical frame as well as Anthony Hopkins.
No, that's the thing. Like, you're watching him, and like you said, like he's smaller, he's not exactly ripped, he's older, his hair is receding halfway back up his head. It's the eyes that carry the threat.
Yeah.
More so than anything. It's that just intenseness. The way he doesn't look at her. He looks right through her.
Have you met anyone scary in real life? Like a proper fucking lad that would kill you?
Yeah.
Right. And you know, they don't have to be physically imposing, no. Do they? They're just fucking scary. No,
the most terrifying fella I ever met was about 5'4".
There you go. That's exactly what I'm talking about. Hopkins is absolutely channeling that shit right here in this performance. It's amazing. Yeah. And you're right, it's through the eyes.
Yeah, it's through the eyes, and it's the tempo of his voice. It's that cadence. And it's just that perfect delivery. And there's like an eeriness and a creepiness to the voice, but they don't disguise the threat of the voice. It's almost like, you know, you watch horror films and it's a dark room and you hear a voice and the voice would put the shits up you. Well, he does that, except you can see he's there and his voice is still terrifying. And it's just, it's phenomenal. The hair greased back.
Yeah.
That does sort of, it gives him more of a toughness to him as well. Like, if he just had, like, a side parting or something, it wouldn't. But he has, there is, even though, like we said, like, he's not tall, he's not well-built, he's not ripped or anything, but he does look sort of battle-hardened with the hair slicked back. You could kind of picture, you know, some Irish gangster from New York from the 40s would have looked a little bit like that. And he was more of a street fighter who'd go out, drink 15 pints, kick lumps out of a fella, and then go back in and go in the shorts because he wouldn't want people thinking he was an alcoholic or something. and that's kind of that short, squat look. But the facial expressions, the fact that nothing else moves, it's just the eyes glaring through her and the mouth, and everything else is just, it'd put the shivers up you even thinking about
it. I don't know if people are that familiar with his back catalogue, but in the much remade movie, The Bounty or Mutiny on the Bounty or whatever version of it they do, that incredible story that's been retold so many times. In the 84 version, he plays Captain Bly, who's kind of nominally the bad guy. You know, he's the tough ass captain who's overthrown and all the rest of it. And Hopkins is, again, you can see him. He's looking around at other people in the cast, and especially like Fletcher Christian, played by Day-Lewis. And he's a smaller man, but he's just this almost sort of overflowing ball of rage. And what he does, again, it's a voice thing. He can say a million words in a couple of seconds, and it's intonation, like you noted there, that's unusual. If you remember Ben Kingsley's performance in Sexy Beast.
Yes.
Now, that's a small man who would scare the living shit out of you.
Yeah.
And again, he's not afraid to do weird things with his voice and his intonation because he would kill you. And you can't possibly laugh at it. And the performance is Bligh in The Bounty is very strange. If I don't know if people are interested in it or not, but Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon do a show called The Trip, where they go around various places.
Brilliant.
And they sit in and they have normally go to restaurants, taste the food and see the beautiful scenery and all these places they go. But it's an excuse to get the two lads doing impressions against each other. And both of them, but particularly Brydon's Hopkins, is incredible. And they, in this case, Hopkins has chosen as Bligh to do sort of some sort of a, like an almost like a North Country accent mixed with some sort of, you know, standard posho voice. And it's really, really impressive. And whatever this sort of vaguely nasal voice he has in this, it just works.
Yeah.
It just works. It shouldn't work. It should be camp. But it's an absolute tribute to this guy that he's managed to make it not that way. And I'm sure you looked a little bit at the background this guy were familiar with anyway. And, you know, people may not know that Hopkins is Welsh. They may not know that, you know, I think he did like the usual little bit of national service and all the rest of it. But he is a RADA graduate. Like Anthony Hopkins is a lad who would have played in all the Shakespeare classics. Mm. He like RADA, you know, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts it's the pinnacle of acting, theater acting in England. You're talking about, you know, the likes of Olivier and all the rest of them who came through it. And later on, I'm fairly sure Ken Branagh as well. But this guy has always had that. And again, he's always had those slightly unusual looks when he was younger. He was darker and more brooding, I guess. Mm. In a way. But, you know, you saw him in classics like A Bridge Too Far that people would be familiar with in 77 with like 10,000 stars. He famously worked with David Lynch in The Elephant Man in 1980, yeah. Another of my favorites. And I'm only picking out some of them here. The Bounty, I've mentioned, fantastic.
Great film. I highly recommend people watch that.
Probably
the 84 version. The cast is unbelievable.
Yeah, it's probably the best version, right? It probably is. And then, you know, there are a couple of other things. But then Silence of the Lambs is the next big, big, big old hit some 6 years later. And it's interesting because it could have felt for him almost as if Hollywood had passed him by. But no, it was only starting for Anthony at this stage.
That's the thing. Like he'd always, like there's a couple obviously where he does play a lead role in a big film. But like, as you said, like through most of the 80s, he was still first and foremost a theater actor. Like that was his primary thing, and it was almost like he was doing film just for the extra money so that he could continue to follow his passion, which was doing theater. But like if you want to know how promising he was as a young actor when he was in RADA, it was Laurence Olivier who personally spotted him and brought him to the Royal National Theater. Like, there couldn't have been a bigger endorsement of a young actor than Laurence Olivier saying, this is the guy. This is the one.
Yeah.
Like, Laurence Olivier is probably the greatest stage actor of all time.
Yeah, absolutely. And think about the difference, Dave, in terms of what you have to do in front of a camera, what you have to do on a stage. You got to be able to project that voice. So that voice is the instrument in the theater in a way that it isn't in film. So it must be immediately a wonderful thing. And that's where he can translate that into this sort of reedy nasal sort of sound that he's got in this. it still absolutely commands your attention.
It's like you said, like if. Let's just say you put this voice on Buffalo Bill with the antics and then it becomes incredibly camp.
It does. It does.
But because it's Hopkins that has this voice and the look and the eyes and everything, it becomes so sinister and so threatening that it really would put the shits up you. Every time he opens his mouth, you get a little shiver up your back, and you're like, oh, Jesus, hope he's not talking to me there.
like the initial interview with Jodie Foster's Clarice, like he's by turns charming and condescending.
Mm.
You know, he's outrageously offensive. There's a wonderful scene later on where he's wheeled out on the dolly to the senator. And he's wearing the Hannibal mask that people have worn for decades since as Halloween costumes. And it's very unnerving. It's a very unnerving thing. The shape of the mask is I suppose it's because it reminds you specifically of what the issue is with this particular fucker here, right? This guy might eat you. It's quite jarring to see, and all trussed up and all the rest of it. And he comes across initially as all charming and just want to help your mom. And here's the thing, and then he's absolutely obnoxious to her, talking about you breastfeed and focusing on her nipples and stuff like that, and what they might feel like or taste like or whatever. And it's like, Jesus Christ, this guy is. You survive by his whim, I guess is what I'm saying. And the film, the way it ends with the sort of the phone call with Clarice, she has confidence that it would be bad manners for him to do anything to her, so he's not going to. And he kind of confirms it through the phone call. I'm not looking for you, whatever. But this is the feeling you get. Now, imagine, Dave, the acting skill it requires in the particular shape and frame and head that Anthony Hopkins has to make anyone, and let alone an audience of billions, believe that anyone that he comes into contact with survives by his fucking whim. I mean, that's amazing.
It's incredible. That's amazing. But it's like I said earlier, the way he's built before we even see him. I missed it when they come down in the lift. Anthony Heald and Clarice, and he said this is what he did to the nurse. We don't see the picture, but he says, oh, they were able to reattach her jaw.
Oh.
And you're thinking, Jesus, what? Like the way they build him up before we see him, and then the minute you meet him and how sinister and how threatening he appears. But then, like you said, he plays it off with that charm, which actually makes him more sinister because we know what he's about. We know he's Hannibal the Cannibal. We know he's capable of ripping someone's jaw off with his own teeth. And yet he's got this charming, what would be a disarming nature if you didn't already know that he's an absolute psychopath.
Plus this outrageous level of erudition. Plus this outrageous level of sophistication in terms of his taste. And, you know, he's hugely sophisticated in terms of, you know, culturally as well. So he's just this unique one-off creature. That's why I think he could support a TV show, because, again, you have this guy who is just more clever than you, knows more about Dante's Inferno than you ever will, knows which wine to have with that particular type of pork. So he has you on the back foot immediately, I think, because he's just, it's weird, isn't it, Dave? The character over the years has become almost superhuman because he just is better than you.
Yeah.
In almost every way. He knows more than you. Like his initial interactions with Clarice are so condescending, talking about cheap shoes and how she has some taste and she's so ambitious. And, you know, the way he dismisses her her little questionnaire, the famous line where he says, you know, a census taker once tried to test me. I ate his kidney beans, I ate his kidney with some fava beans and a nice Chianti, the line that everybody knows from the film. And the sucking noise afterwards, and the mad eyes as we look at it again with Demi's close ups on the face.
But it's also when he says to her, "Crawford sent a woman." Like he basically tells her, "You're being used here," but it's him immediately establishing the power. Like you're only a puppet. you've been sent to me. So he very quickly wants to establish the dynamic and the power structure here of you will dance to the beat of my drum. I will not to yours.
And you almost believe, don't you, that he knows exactly what's going to happen, that this absolutely gruesome jizz attack from Miggs is going to happen, and that he will shout and roar at her to come back, and she will come back. She has enough about her not to be so overwhelmed by that she will come back, and he will be able to give her a hint. And you feel like it's all part of his overall manipulation, that he's entirely in charge of every situation at every time. It is like you do actually get that feeling that he's, you know, like I say, it's everything's almost at his whim, and he gives her the little pity tip about Miss Moffat, and we get this whole thing about his clever little anagrams that she's the only one he can work out. And, you know, they're testing each other's erudition. She seems to pass his acceptability test. And then we find out that Miggs, who has launched his output at her is dead.
Yeah,
because Hannibal's been talking to him all night. He's just talking to him all night, and I think we hear he swallows his tongue or something. But he talks him into taking his own life.
Yeah,
this is what I mean about this guy is fucking terrifying.
Yeah, that ability to have complete control over another person without any physical touch. With Miggs, without even seeing him, he's not even able to use the eyes, the look. It's just his voice.
Yeah.
To be able to control a person by his voice, it is incredible direction.
And why would he do that? It's only a sign of his fealty or admiration, or it's because he's fucking offended by Miggs's behavior.
Yeah. So, yeah, because that's not gentlemanly behavior.
Yeah, that's it.
Because at the end of it, Lecter sees himself as the gentleman. And like when Clarice said, oh, he'd see it as bad manners because he's a gentleman. That's the preeminent thing about Lecter, the way he sees himself. Yes, he's incredibly well educated. Yes, he's an absolute psychopath. Yes, he eats other humans, but at the root of it all, he believes himself to be the ultimate gentleman. And he only hurts people who he feels warrant him hurting them. Like he's almost presenting himself as like the anti-hero. Like he's doing bad, but for the purpose of good. It's one of the great characters there's ever been. And Thomas Harris I don't think he gets enough credit for how good he is. But to create a character like this is just incredible.
Yeah, well, you've made it like if that is your creation, like, you know, obviously his tip leads to this really jarring scene of finding a head in a jar and Jodius going to his creepy lockup and all the rest of it. But one of the little things that doesn't tend to get noticed that I thought was fantastic and again establishes the Hannibal character is when she goes back to him, having, you know, she kind of injured herself on the way in, catches her leg on the door of the lockup. He says, you're bleeding, because he can smell the blood, right? And you're just thinking, oh, God, that little detail freaked me out so much at the time. It really did. And, of course, he offers the help, and we see the little bit of Bill's victim, his first victim, and we see the night vision, Dave. And, again, 1990, this is before Call of Duty or anybody knew really much about any of this stuff. This is, like, what we thought was cutting-edge technology, because it kind of half was. I know there was iterations of it beforehand. But it was the creepy booting up sound of the night vision as well. Later on, you've got the creepy sound of the camera, the really powerful sort of sound of the autopsy camera. And the sound edit's really good on this. And those noises are used to deliberately unsettle you. And the sound of the night vision absolutely does that. The effect of it is great as well. And, you know, like we said, we're off to the races then. We're introduced to Bill and the story starts panning out. There is, again, a couple of other set pieces that I want to get back to. I think this one of the over and backs, the quid pro quo section, where we have the over and back between Jody and Anthony and establishing the characters, establishing the trust. And absolutely, it's all on his terms. You know, he keeps that condescending tone all the way through. But I would like to get into that with you as well. I'm just, you know, we're coming up towards the hour. What do you think? Will we just pick a couple of key moments each that we want to talk about and sort of wrap it up that way? Or is there any other big thing that you want to chat about outside of specific highlights from the film?
No, just we pick a couple of highlights and we can go through the rest of what takes place. Obviously, there's some big moments left to go, but I mean, we don't want to take away too much so that people still have reason to go and watch it as well, because if you haven't seen this film, you have to watch. This is one of those films that you just have to watch. Even if horror is not your bag, watch this. And if you get scared easily, watch it at 10 o'clock in the morning so you've got the rest of the day to recover.
Solid advice there from young Hendrik. So in the vein of wanting to talk about a couple of things that you can't not mention, how about Bill's lair? I mean, how good is that in terms of the creepiness of it? The layout is incredible, but just, you know, the whole end sequence, you realize it's in this sort of really messed up basement and everything's sort of decrepit and falling apart and creepy as all hell. But even in the sort of living quarters section, you know, you've got mannequins and sort of proto skin suits and
dirt. Just lots of dirt.
And moths everywhere. And sort of the fact that he seems to have this interest in entomology and, well, specifically the moth and the butterfly, because that's the kind of symbol, the symbol of change. Because this guy, Jamie Gumm, who's the central character, Buffalo Bill, he has this identity crisis issue going on. And, you know, it's probably, there's probably some language here now that, you know, is in this section that sort of seems outmoded, outdated. But I will say that I don't think there's a condescension in the way that it's presented. I think actually the way that Hannibal speaks about Jamie Gumm, it's very interesting. He talks about how his issue is deep-seated identity issue from a childhood of abuse, and the way that he's projecting it is into he says he thinks that, you know, going from male to female will be this change that he needs. But Hannibal tells us that his pathology is far, far more violent and dangerous than that, and that the guy doesn't really understand himself, that what he's turning into, that won't be sufficient at all, because this guy, what he's really turning into is this absolutely violent killer, and the two things aren't connected at all. And I think there's been some sort of misunderstanding of that over the years. I think it's really well done. The character of Hopkins, with his erudition, the character of Hannibal splits the two things off and says, no, it's got nothing to do with the fact. His violence is not linked to the fact that, you know, he's manifesting this change as going from male to female. No, in fact, the change is what he's becoming. He's becoming this absolutely violent, sadistic, dark murderer who has this fetish about, you know, using the skin of women. That's, I think, really well handled, actually, contrary to some of the lazy criticism you might see about it.
Yeah, I agree. And I think Lecter describes it really well. And like you said, I mean, you could take it in one way, but you have to factor in who's saying it and why he's saying it and how he views the world. And it does give you a really good insight into the Buffalo Bill character, who, I mean, just again, like with Lecter, what an incredible creation. I know he's borrowed from real serial killers from the past. Ed Gein, in this case, you'd imagine would have been a big influence on the Buffalo Bill character, but just so brilliantly done by Thomas Harris to create this character and then to have him described in this way. It really does just, like, again, as with Before We Met Lecter, I know we've already seen Buffalo Bill at this point, but the way Lecter describes him really gives you an insight into who he is and what he is.
Yeah, his playful reference to him as Billy all the way through it as well. You know, I really like that's one of the highlights for me, is the way that he's so absolutely outrageously condescending about everyone, because it's coming from that place of just self-awareness that he is in fact a superior human to almost everybody. My last thing I want to talk about is the whole cage setup and that like unforgettable passage of film. Because it is genuinely, again, incredibly directed. It works as thriller, it works as horror, it works in every single way you can imagine. Brilliant performance, brilliant acting, wonderful set piece. I don't want to talk about that. That's the last thing I want to talk about. If it coincides with what you want to, then we can maybe finish there. But can I just throw in one little thing? Because when Clarice is trying to get to the bottom of what's going on with these bugs shoved into people's mouths and secreted on their persons, there was one in the head in the jar, and then there's one in one of the victims' mouths, which in and of itself is incredibly, that autopsy sequence is incredibly powerful. I mentioned that earlier. She brings it to two bug nerds, two kind of entomologists, scientist guys. And one of the absolute revelations for me watching it last night was this bug nerd who can't, you know, really communicate with women and is sort of real awkward, nerdy scientist type is Bulldog from Frasier, which I did not realize until last night. I love that. I was looking at his face going, hang on, is it? I just little things like that are absolute, like, they're the little bonuses when you're rewatching something. For me, is you go, oh yeah, that's that guy from, you know. So I did enjoy that little moment. Is there anything else you want to pick out before we have a look at that whole ridiculously incredible sequence, which is around and about the whole Hannibal in a cage part?
No, just like you said, seeing Bulldog make an appearance, considering, you know, Frasier obviously comes, I think, 2 years after this, but I would have known him from Frasier. And I like I said, I've seen this film a bunch of times. I noticed it, not on my watch last night, I noticed it on the watch beforehand, with herself during the week, that it was him. And I was like, how have I never noticed that that's him?
Yeah, I know.
But as well, like Frankie Faison as well. Like, I know him primarily from The Wire.
Yeah.
He plays Irving Berell.
Yeah.
And then I was like, that's Berell. I was like, how have I not noticed that before? And then I end up going down the rabbit hole and looking at Burrell's filmography and all the different stuff he's done, and it's absolutely incredible how much stuff he's done over the years. But like, it's the setup into this cage scene, like when he meets the senator, like you mentioned that earlier on, like there's just when they wheel him out as if he's a keg on a trolley.
I know.
And you just and he's strapped to it, and he's in the straitjacket, and he's got the mask on, and all of the guards that are with him are very clearly on edge. It's just brilliantly done, and it sets up that meeting with the senator, which starts well. And then takes a strange turn.
And you know, those guards are on edge until they aren't, because he's sort of charmed them, and they think, you know, he's a good old boy, you know, and it's the sequence from the arrival of the dinner with the lamb chops on that I really want to talk about, because that's for me one of the most powerful sequences that I've seen in a film, end of story. I don't care what genre, what era, it's incredible. The tension is ratcheted right to the top and keeps it there. It's really well done. But like you say, he's really brought himself that he shows himself for the animal that he is in the interaction with the senator, and then he gives away all the details and shows that he's actually just, he has got good intentions or he wants to help, and then she goes again utterly disgusted. She can't take this sort of good and bad news at once all on board, and she's gone again, and he calls her back. He says, "Love your suit." And you're like, what are you? There's something about him. But I don't know what you thought, but all this stuff in the cage was fascinating to me. When Clarice arrives and he's reading a book, and there's another book, and I'm going, what the fuck are these books? And I was trying to pause and watch and pause and watch. I couldn't get the titles. And I even put into Google, what are the books that Hannibal is reading in the cage scene? Nothing on Google had it for me. And I think one of them might be Dante, but I'm not sure. It just says poetry on the book, but I don't know what it is. But that was driving me mental. And, you know, he gets the full story of the, you know, the orphanage in Bozeman and the ranch that she goes to. He wheedles the full horror of Jodie's childhood out of her in this scene, which I think is important, because if she hadn't been so frank and honest, then I don't think she gets away with it. I think she might be next on the hit list by the end of the film. I think it's important in terms of establishing the trust that she is brave enough to be so frank in this scene and emotionally vulnerable enough, but also perhaps because she, in her own cynical way, as a really, really brilliant detective agent, is calculating what that will glean her in terms of, you know, the quid pro quo, the famous quid pro quo. But I don't know if you noticed, when he gets the guards on, sort of, they're casual now with him, you know, and they're joking that he wants a couple of rare lamb chops. I mean, the symbolism is fantastic.
Yeah.
Lamb chops, right? He wants some rare lamb chops. Oh, by the way, The Silence of the Lambs is a title. That always confused me. I'm going to ask you that at the end, right? Because the whole story is about the screaming of the lamb. So I want to get back to that at the end. If I forget, remind me. Anyway, the lamb chops arrive, and then he does what he does. It's this incredible sequence. We saw earlier on the close-up on the pen that Chilton leaves. We know something's going to come of that. Anyway, Hannibal has taken a little piece of metal from it. He managed to get out of his cuffs. This sequence is absolutely horrific and horrifying and so powerful. He literally eats a lad's face, and the other fella, he has him cuffed. He's going to have an even worse fate. It's so graphic. You really don't see it coming. And nothing in any movie, no matter how much they try to shock you with glorious exploding heads on everything that Netflix puts out now, it can all just piss off to the halfpenny place. Because this is just so much more, I think, just ghoulish. The concept of the way he flays, he sort of disembowels the guy and hangs him up and uses the American flag as wings, and how did he haul him up there, and creating his own sort of ghoulish art, and the fact then that he is hiding it with the face of the other lad on him.
Yeah.
Jesus, Dave, I remember the first time I thought that, I was like, that is one of the most disturbing things I've ever seen. I watched it again last night, you know, whatever, 30 years after watching the original. It does not relent in its
ghoulish. It's still really disturbing.
it's really disturbing. And when he sits up in the ambulance and takes the face off.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
And the blood is just all over his own face from the inside of the other face. But you know, when the scene with the lift, before he sits up in the ambulance,
there's your tension. That's what.
Yeah, and you're like, why is there blood dripping from the ceiling? Maybe he's killed someone else. Maybe he's gone that way and he's just happened to kill someone else and he's chucked him into a lift shaft or something. And it's just so brilliantly done. My assumption is that the idea of him flailing your man and putting him up on the thing is to show the physical strength of him.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? This guy can do whatever he wants.
But like it's the artistic way as well. He sets it out. Like, it's just, it's brilliant. But again, it plays to the mind of Lecter, like of this, of perfection.
Did you notice, like, as the dinner's arriving, the camera pans across, the music's playing, he's doing his little hand gestures, he's listening to his music, and as it pans across the table that he's got in his little cage quarters, there's a pencil drawing of Clarice holding a fucking lamb in sort of grand romantic ball gown type fare, but it's romanticized version of Clarice holding a lamb. I had never noticed that until last night.
Yeah. And he's obviously gotten, she's earned his respect, and she doesn't cower from him in the same way that many others do. And she shows him the respect that he feels he warrants as well. And I think that's, like, with the quid pro quo and the way he was testing her and giving her the little riddles and puzzles, trying to see, was she, you know, is she intelligent enough to be on my level, to hold a conversation with me? And I think all of that, he becomes kind of infatuated with her as well as a result of that.
That's it. There's a fascination on his part with her, because this is something we shouldn't underestimate either. The character of Clarice is, you know, it's not just, she's not just like, oh, a good cop or whatever, or brave. She has this sort of intuitive intelligence as well that he really respects. You know, she can read him too. And she's not afraid to show her disdain for his little parlor tricks as well, which again suggests a certain level of erudition that she has. That's, it's all those things have fooled everybody else. She comes back and she speaks to him with disdain about them. You know, your little anagram's not fooling anybody anymore. You know, that kind of way. And I think it's important that she, obviously, who could be on a level with this guy? But he respects her as a sort of, if not adversary, then someone who he can at least have an interaction with, that he can admire and see levels of intelligence and levels of emotional intelligence as well, that he finds at least a little bit fascinating.
Yeah, exactly. And it's so well laid out and so well put together. And like you said, the editing is a big factor in it, but the dynamic between them, the way it develops and flows, and it's just like you rarely see it in, certainly not in what is a horror film. Like, you just don't see that type of character depth and the link between two like we're seeing in this.
If you had to wrap it up then, because we are kind of getting to that stage where very interesting going down any sort of other number of tones. We haven't really spoken about Scott Glenn, who deserves a chat. And there's also other things we could talk about. I haven't done Anthony Hopkins half enough justice. We stopped the Hopkins discussion in 1990. And like I said earlier on, he's
definitely only really getting going then.
He's only starting. Hollywood's only realized what they have in Anthony Hopkins at that point. So there are other things we can talk about there. But just like in the spirit of sort of drawing it to a conclusion around the 80, 82 minute mark, we've spoken about a lot of movies, and we're going to talk about a lot of movies, and they're going to be classics, and they're going to be, brilliant in their own way. I find it very hard to think of anything that we've spoken about that is on a level with this, in terms of when everything comes together correctly: direction, performance, cinematography, and music, and the sound edit as well. Performance, obviously, it's hard to think of a thing, of a more perfect little nugget of a thing than this film. Do you know what I mean? It warrants classic status in every way. We don't care where you approach it from. It warrants that classic status, in my opinion, that I really hope most people see it as having.
Yeah, and I mean, like, this film could easily have been made too long, because if you think back to that time, there was a bunch of three-hour films that were being made. And this could easily have been drawn out. If DeMay had decided he was going to draw it out for the 40 minutes or an hour, there was stuff that he, you know, there was threads he could have pulled at to kind of make bigger certain things that happened. But I think he just chose the timing and pace of it absolutely brilliant. And one of the things I love about this film, so this is the only film thus far to ever win the Best Picture at the Academy Awards as a horror film. And it's only a small thing because he's barely in it. But the fact that George A. Romero is in this film, who's like obviously one of the most iconic horror directors of all time, I just love that little, the fact that he's just in this film, which went on to win that award from a genre that he helped craft, is brilliant. And George A. Romero's, there's just two lovely little stories about him. One is that when he was a teenager, he used to travel into New York to rent a film called The Tales of Hoffman from a little video store. The only other person that used to rent that film regularly was Martin Scorsese from the same video store. They're the only two people that used to rent it out regularly, which is just an incredible little meaningless but brilliant anecdote. But also, when he passed away, he was listening to the score of one of his favorite films, The Quiet Man, which, just when you think of The Tales of Hoffman, The Quiet Man, how on earth did he end up being the king of the zombie movie? Like,
I know.
Just doesn't really, it doesn't put piece together properly, but again, just brilliant. We could go on, and we could talk about more about, you know, the fact that this guy seems to have a well in his basement, and that whole scene, and the fact that they all, you know, all the FBI guys, they all go somewhere else to raid a house. Clarice has the meeting with the girl who tells her the story. She goes unaccompanied. The way she acts with the girl who's in, like, she gets there and she's not really there so much to save the girl. She's there to stop the guy. And, like, because she could help her out of the pit, but instead her sole focus is on, I might save one, but if he gets away, he's going to kill more. And I think that's a really interesting thing. Like, it's almost like she's there because Hopkins is clearly disgusted by this guy.
Yeah.
And it's Lecter's disgusted by him. It's almost like she's there as a messenger from Lecter to kill him.
Yeah, meanwhile, the poor devil down the bottom of the well is abusing the shit out of Clarice, saying, you fucking bitch, get back here and help me, you know? It is. And, like, again, it's another wonderful set piece in a movie full of them. But, you know, like you say, we could go on tangents and know what two better lads to do, but we should wrap it up there because we want to keep these things within a sort of a... We're always coming in sub-90 on anything like this, but we make no apologies about having a longer podcast than you might be used to. Break it up into pieces if you like, and do, you know, give it a good listen over a couple of settings if that's how you need to do it. I'm the kind of person who listens to stuff for hours on end, so I understand that is a bit different to most people, but hopefully, you know, it's the kind of thing you can jump back into. We do try to do it that way, that it is a sort of a ramble chat, and it is accessible, and it is full of anecdotes, and it is full of sidelines, and hopefully that's the kind of thing that will keep you coming back for more. We've been very gratified by what you guys have said to us about the show so far. And again, just to reiterate a point I made, I'm not sure if I was quite clear about it. Again, Dave can have his own take on this, but this is just my own personal one. You know, it is lovely to hear from people, but you know, I am not interested really in hearing critiques, and that doesn't mean that I'm not open to self-improvement, but nobody knows better when you've done something wrong than the person themselves. So in other words, if I've made a show and I didn't get out of a topic quick enough, or I let my emotions get in the way and derail the conversation, or I stepped on a guest and you know, when they were trying to answer a question or whatever, nobody knows that more than I do. So the last thing I need is some ham on Twitter telling me about that. So when people say, you know, let us know what you think, you give us feedback. If it's going to be negative, just piss off into the wind with that. I don't want to hear it. No interest. You know, we have enough self-criticism here that we can work out what's gone wrong. We can do it for ourselves. Thanks very much. Thankfully, with this show so far, I don't think a whole lot has. I've been very, very...
A few people seem to blame us for them not liking...
this is the thing. So, I mean, like, God bless. You know, I have at it, but just please bear in mind that these are things where we are having conversation, and we do not need in any way, shape or form to conform to any sort of standards in terms of other people's tastes. We are just simply doing this to provide some entertainment for folks and entertain ourselves in the process, which I think is painfully obvious that we are having the crack while we're doing it. So like I said, feel free to get in touch with us when you're saying nice things. Otherwise, keep to yourself, because, you know, I we're both sort of borderline, you know, like I'm more overtly nice lad, but both of us have a bit of the lectern in us.
I'm just a horrible cunt, is what I am. So
just keep me. You don't want to be bringing out our inner Hannibal, so just keep it to yourselves. Anyway, we'll wrap it up with that slightly dark and threatening note after our little happy chat.
It's the lectern. We've been talking about this guy for an hour and a half. That's him.
It's him.
If they could see my eyes now, I'm not looking at them. I'm looking right through them all.
You get that product out of your hair as well, please. You're freaking me out. We'll leave it at that. This has been Buzzed. I'm Trev Denny. That was Dave Hendrick. We'll be back with you for another one on Chris Nolan and his works very soon.
Sports Social Podcast Network.